let's continue on dealing with this matter of righteousness that comes from God, which is completely apart from, absolutely separate from the law. That's where we closed here with point 16, the phrase apart from the law. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested. 17, specifically, one might say it has nothing to do with obedience to the law. As Schreiner has observed, the term namu, law, is probably shorthand for the phrase the works of the law from verse 20. And where he uses, I think, that entire phrase in verse 20, here, as he goes through this, he will either talk about works or law. He doesn't always use the entire phrase works of the law, but if you look in verse 28, he uses the full phrase there. And so we will see that the point is here the idea, again, are works done in obedience to a standard that are supposed to engender somehow God's approbation and provide salvation, justification. 18, the phrase righteousness from God is identical to what was found in chapter 1, which declared that the gospel was what revealed how one could obtain righteousness from God. And that's the content, as we were told in his initial. And again, this is his thesis, essentially, of the whole book, is the gospel of God. I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation that results in salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for in it righteousness from God is revealed from faith to faith. And as it is written, the righteous man shall live by faith. So 19, in chapter 1, Paul indicated that the righteousness from God was being revealed through the gospel on an ongoing basis, as seen in the present tense of apokalupto, being revealed or being known, being uncovered is actually, to uncover is the idea of apokalupto, hence to reveal something. The word apocalypse, the English anglicized version of the Greek, is a title for the revelation, the book. 20, here in chapter 3, Paul uses a different verb, phanerao, to make visible or to reveal publicly. In the perfect tense, to focus on the visible work of Christ. This is designed to emphasize the reality that the first advent manifested the way to God's righteousness in a manner in which it had previously not been revealed. That there is this matter of revelation now, greater revelation, brings greater culpability. And so the human race is on the hook in a way after the first advent that they weren't before. Now, they're too dumb to know it because they're spiritually dead and other factors. But that's the case. Now, there's been a major shift here, a major revelation factor in which we can know exactly what it takes to gain God's favor without any question. Now, one might say, well, you couldn't really put it all together from the Old Testament. You could have, but you would have had to have been one a tremendous believer to really put it all together in that way, other than figuring out salvation by faith. You could figure that one out. But to put the whole thing together as it's seen in Christ with the death, burial, and resurrection and all of that, that just makes it all so plain. There's no question now. 21, in the first case, the revelation continually takes place through the proclamation of the gospel. In chapter 3, the revelation takes place through the events of the gospel and remains manifest for all time. And again, the difference between whether you're giving a verbal witness to the truth or there was a literal physical witness to the truth, as there was in the life of Christ and in his death, burial, and resurrection. So 22, in one sense, with the events of the first advent, there was a new, complete revelation of the plan of God that had not been previously observed. And 23, again, however, one should not think that this revelation was different than what was contained in the Old Testament, since righteousness from God was itself the subject of Old Testament teaching. 24, the question, one of the questions certainly that arises, is whether or not one believes that the Old Testament taught a law of righteousness. And many people believe that. Many people believe that the Jews were saved by a compliance with their law. But that never was the case. Or that a faith righteousness was always God's intention. And again, there are passages, and we will look, we're going to have pause. I'm not going to look at it here at length because it's going to come up in chapter 4. But this verse Paul takes is very important in that, number one, Abraham is not circumcised when this happens. This verse is prior to circumcision. And number two, this verse is his premier proof text that faith righteousness was always God's plan, and it has been manifest. That's how Abraham was saved, is his argument. Genesis 15:6, then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And again, we're going to have, because the question becomes, kind of, you have to ask, is he saying here that Abraham just now for the first time believed when he got this confirmation? Now, this is after he went out, this is after he rescued Lot from the invading kings. And rescued, again, Sodom and some of those people from these invaders. And after these things, in verse chapter 15, verse 1, the word of the Lord came to Abram. See, he hasn't had the name change yet either, but he's still referred to as Abram. Do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward will be very great. And he said, O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, since you have given no offspring to be, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir. Forget about that. We're not plugging this guy in here as the fulfillment of the promise. This is not, but one who will come forth from your own body, he will be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the stars, look toward the heavens, and count the stars. Good luck. And see if you are able to count them. And he said, so shall your descendants be. And in the flow of the context here, if you just read this in the English, it sounds like this is where Abraham gets saved. Because the flow of it would naturally seem, then he believed God and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Well, Abraham was saved prior to this. And there's actually a tip in the Hebrew that's there. And again, I'm not going to get sidetracked on it today. We'll deal with it in chapter 4 because it is coming up. But there's a clue in there in the Hebrew that he's not saying he got saved right then. But what he is saying is that the important matter for Abraham was he was justified by faith. Righteousness was reckoned or imputed or credited to him by faith. Where God sees faith, he imputes righteousness. And nowhere is that more true, of course, critically, than in salvation. Also, Psalm 44. So we'll get a big dose of Abraham coming up. And like I said, that's why I don't want to go all into that today. But again, this is where if you don't know the languages, you're going to screw up Genesis 15. You're going to screw up lots of things if you don't know the languages. But that one you're really going to mess up because the English won't get it for you there. Psalm 44, how blessed is the man who has made the Lord his trust. In other words, who's put his faith in the Lord and has not turned to the proud nor to those who lapse into falsehood. Psalm 84:12 also. So again, there's little tips and clues in here in the Old Testament that if you read properly and understood, 84:12. You see these references to faith being the necessity. Trusting, believing. Again, however you want to translate some of these words, but they're all the same, essentially. O Lord of the armies, Lord of hosts, how blessed is the man who trusts in you. And Isaiah 53:1. Who has, worked for our message? No, who has believed it? I mean, that's the question right there. Why the emphasis on believing the message? Because it's the faith, it's the belief. And that's all faith is believing what you're told. And again, as we know, this is one of the reasons why little children are great at this. This is why Jesus had a real affinity for them, because they readily believe what they're told. Again, you have the breaking and entering every year at Christmas that they believe, you know, is all good for them. That this weird guy comes into their house and he leaves presents. He doesn't steal stuff. If you leave him some cookies, he's, you know, likes that. Well, and I remember, I must have been fairly naive because I had to be 9 or 10 before I finally figured this out. I mean, most kids, I think, maybe figure it out before then. But I was still pretty gullible. I'm actually, you might find this hard to believe, but I'm a pretty trusting person, which gets me into trouble sometimes. But the fact is, kids believe what they're told, generally speaking. And that's all faith is. It's just putting your trust in what somebody tells you. Now, if your faith is in the wrong object, if it's in the wrong information, well, that's not going to serve you. But if it's in the right information, that's great. So the question here is, who has believed our message? And thus, to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? So 25 here, it is certainly clear that Moses envisioned a prophet greater than himself. And that Jeremiah anticipated a new covenant that would replace the Mosaic covenant. This is the prophecy in Deuteronomy 18 with respect to the coming Messiah, but again, not understood by the Jews, because that's pretty clear when they come to John the Baptist and they start quizzing him and they say, "Are you the prophet? Are you the Messiah? Well, who are you then? I mean, what are you doing? What authority are you claiming to be out here doing your deal? Baptizing these people." So Deuteronomy 18:15, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen, and you will listen to him. And this is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, 'Let me not again hear the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see his great fire anymore, or I will die.'" See, when God did these theophanies, these manifestations of his presence, it would have scared the daylights out of you. If you were there, I mean, you're standing around this mountain and it's constantly in motion. It's a constant earthquake. How do people feel in earthquakes? Safe? Mm-hmm. And then when God came down to manifest himself on top of the mountain, he came down in this big ball of fire. And the top of the mountain is still out there. If you go find it, it's out there, Mount Sinai. It's scorched. The proper Mount Sinai, not the one that they take the tourists to down on the Sinai Peninsula. It's not there. That's why they can't find it. But so when God manifested himself and there was loud thunders. How do people feel in the middle of a huge thunderstorm? And then factor in earthquake, thunderstorm, and fire. Now, if that happens at your house today, you are not going to be a happy camper. And these people were scared to death, and rightly so, because God wanted to let people know. Why does God intentionally scare people? Because the matter of his holiness, his righteousness, his separateness is emphasized in all of this. That, hey, you better keep in perspective who I am. And these are just minor manifestations of God's essence and power. This isn't the full glory of it. If God had manifested himself on the planet Earth, everybody would be dead. This is why the deity of Christ had to be veiled in humanity. Although, as we saw on the Mount of Transfiguration, it was still there. But it was limited. It was veiled. God had to veil himself as a human in order to, for a bunch of reasons. But not the least of which is it would have killed everybody if he hadn't. That's a big one. So this is scary here for them. "And the Lord said to me, 'They have spoken well. They're wise not to want this. I will raise up a prophet from among your countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he will speak all that I command him. And it will come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he will speak in my name, I myself will require it of him.'" Essentially a statement that if people do not believe in the Messiah, they're going to pay the price. That's what he's essentially saying here. Also, Jeremiah 31. And this passage is critical, in some sense, to the understanding that the Mosaic Covenant never was intended to be the full revelation. It was, at best, a partial revelation. And a revelation that emphasized the righteousness of God, but with very little information about how to orient to him. There's some information in there because he says, and we've got that coming up here, it was testified about, this matter of salvation by faith, was testified in the law and the prophets. Well, that passage we just read in Deuteronomy, what did it say? The one who doesn't listen to him, i.e. the one who doesn't believe him, he's going to pay the penalty. This is the way it's going to work. So Jeremiah 31, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant, a new contract with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It's not going to be like the contract I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant, which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. And this is one of the regular features of the Old Testament indictments of Israel, is that they are viewed as an adulterous wife. That the Lord himself was a perfect husband, treated her right, and she rebelled against him and went out and fornicated with all these other people. And that's a spiritual fornication, not physical. So the sexual background to this is designed to be shocking because people would view that, generally speaking, moral, righteous, you know, demure females don't typically do this. But Israel did. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. Now see, the law before was written on tablets of what? Stone. And so they're there, they're fixed, they are what they are, but very cold and impersonal, as you might imagine. And when you compare this idea about writing the law on their heart, in other words, in the inner man, there's going to be a fundamental change. And this is teaching, again, about the ministry, the coming ministry of Christ, all that that's going to result in the ministry of God, the Holy Spirit within the believer, and the dynamic of doctrine within the inner man. That's what God's headed for. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. I will be their God, and they will be my people. They will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more. And this new covenant, by the way, while it just kind of wraps up here at the very end, this new covenant is all about forgiveness of sins. That's the adjunct. You got kind of a negative and a positive aspect to justification. You got the positive aspect, the imputation of righteousness. You got the negative aspect, forgiveness of sins. You got to have both. And both are implied in justification. Abraham will deal with it, sort of coming up in chapter 4. Paul deals with it from the perspective of Abraham in the positive sense. Abraham believed God and it was imputed to him as righteousness. And then David deals with it in the negative, says, blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven. But they're both dealing with the same matter of justification. So 26, thus the matter of righteousness from God based on faith was not a new subject, if one interpreted and understood the Old Testament properly. Habakkuk 2:4, and that's the verse, by the way, that this verse Paul cites comes out of this one. And it's actually found in a prophecy of the last days. That this prophecy, because he says this is a vision in verse 3, for the appointed time. It's not now. Habakkuk wasn't writing about historical things in his day at this point. He's talking about a future coming incident. And behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him. But the righteous will live by his faith. And so this matter of righteousness and faith, when one carefully considers the Old Testament, the clues are there. It's not as though it wasn't taught. It's just that, number one, it had been de-emphasized by the Jews into a works sort of righteousness. And what they should have been emphasizing was the faith righteousness. Well, they didn't. That's just the nature. Well, Job certainly understood that man could never attain to the standard of God's perfect righteousness. Again, Job is one of the more ancient books written by Moses. And again, likely situated in the time of Isaac or Jacob, somewhere in that period. And the clues to that are really found in the line of Esau. So, again, probably Jacob more likely than Isaac, but I haven't, you can't totally fix a date on this one because obviously we don't need a date for one thing. Doesn't matter when the book of Job was written. We know it's ancient. It was a family, they were still under the family priesthood. That's pretty evident because Job offered sacrifices for his children and all of that. And as the father, he was the family priest. So we're still there, certainly. Job 9, 2 and 3. Job answered and said, "In truth, I know that this is so. But how can a man be right before God? If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in a thousand times." I mean, if God really wants to take you on about your failures, you're not going to have a response. You're not going to have an answer. You're not going to have an excuse. It is what it is. And because all of us are unrighteous, it's easy for him to do that. The same chapter, verses 14 and 15. "And then how can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of the judge." See, Job was smart enough to recognize his any sort of works righteousness didn't commend him to God. And that his righteousness fell short of God. He knew this. And so he says, "I'd have to have mercy from the judge. I can't rely on my own righteousness. There's no way." Also, 19 and 20, "If it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one." You want to deal with this judge? This judge is omnipotent. He's got plenty of power to enforce his findings. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Really, who's going to call God to task? Say, "All right, I'm bringing you to trial, God." Now, Satan may be arrogant enough and stupid enough to try that, but human beings better never. Nobody better ever, because God's righteousness and justice is such they're just never going to succeed. So, if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. And so I stop here because then Job gets back. See, this is an amazing thing here. What he says in verse 19 and the first part of verse 20 is true. And then in verse 20b, "Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty." No, he doesn't do that. This is where Job starts, he interjects. And that's why this book would be tough to do. I mean, I do want to do it someday, but it would be a tough one to do because they're interspersing human viewpoint and divine viewpoint. You've got to figure out which one's which. You can't just read it through and say, "Oh, well, Job's out of fellowship. Everything he says is wrong." No, it's not. Anymore. I mean, you get out of fellowship and don't you still say right things? Just to give you an example. Even if you're out of fellowship right now and I say, "What time is it?" And you look at your watch and you answer, "Well, if you give me the right time, you've told me the truth, haven't you?" You can be out of fellowship and say the right thing. You may even be out of fellowship and say the doctrinally right thing. Doesn't mean you're in fellowship or applying it, but and it's like when you get out of fellowship. Can you imagine if that would be horrible? If we got out of fellowship, we lose all our doctrine the second we get out of fellowship. That would be awful. I'm glad it doesn't work that way. Here he understands, you know, look, I'm not attaining to God's standard of righteousness. And then he throws in, you know, a little bit of self-pity with it. Oh, I'm guiltless, but he might be guilty anyway. No. He doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't understand the whole principle. Satan's behind this, manipulating this situation. And while God's allowing it, he's not doing it. And there's a big difference between doing something and allowing something. The difference between his directive will and his permissive will. And that's huge. So 28, however, that was precisely the problem that Paul and to some extent all adjusted communicators faced. People often believe that they understand the plan of God while being ignorant in various degrees of what the Bible actually says. And I've met people, many, many fundamentalist type people, go to fundy churches, do their thing, blah, blah, blah. And you know what? At the end of the day, they don't understand very much. They don't understand certain basic principles that are pretty evident to me. And so this is what, you know, again, if you have this problem that people think, "I know what it says." Well, do they, though? That's the big issue. My job, of course, is to instruct you so that you do know what it says. And then you're able to combat this stuff and say, "Yeah, no, that's junk. That's stupid. Has nothing to do with God's plan, really. Whatever it is." So 29, "Therefore, while there was an Old Testament works righteousness, it was never going to result in salvation because man could never attain to God's standards due to the matter of his sinfulness. On the other hand, there always existed a faith righteousness by which men actually attain salvation. Again, through here, we're going to deal with salvation, which is the more general term, in terms of justification, which is a specific aspect of salvation, the legal aspect of it. And very much for Paul, justification is a legal matter between God and the believer. And because it's a legal matter, therefore all the laws apply to it. And so God can't, as a legal matter, as a judge, God can't just look the other way when there are sins that have to be addressed, that need to be punished. God can't just look the other way. People who are doing things, God can't just ignore it forever. Now, he's patient with it, we know that. He talked about that there in Romans 2 when he said, don't you know that the kindness of God gives you a chance to change your mind? And so, you know, God may not immediately hammer every sin, but we know he eventually has to. And again, but for those who are doing this works righteousness, they're never attaining to righteousness. Those who quit working and believe, they attain to righteousness. That's the irony, the divine irony. That those who give up trying and trust in God, and trust in the Lord, find out that that's all he wanted all along. He didn't ever want us on this works treadmill. I like the work treadmill because it doesn't go anywhere. You're walking, 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 but you don't go anywhere. And that's the thing with works righteousness. You can work and work and work, but you're never any more righteous than you were when you stepped on that treadmill of works righteousness. Well, point 30 here, verse 23, uses the conjunction duh. Now, but or now, which is normally used in an adversative sense. However, here it's used in an epexegetical sense to more closely define what he means specifically by righteousness from God. When he says, I said that's 23. I'm sorry, that's 22. That changed that in the notes. That's verse 22. I didn't think that was verse 23. Now look at it. No. When he says the righteousness from God has been manifested, namely, specifically, i.e., the righteousness I'm talking about is the righteousness from God through faith in Jesus Christ. That's the one I'm talking about. So again, he uses it here to more closely define what he means specifically by righteousness from God. In 31, Paul now declares that righteousness from God does not come from human works based on legal or moral codes. It comes through faith in Jesus Christ. 32, while there is a new strain of exegesis, there's always nothing new under the sun, but there's new little weird twists people put on stuff. And if you do the history of all of this, you'd find it's true. There's a new strain of exegesis and interpretation that seeks to reclassify the genitive from the commonly understood objective genitive, i.e. Christ is the object of faith, to a subjective genitive. And here they would say it, the righteousness of God comes through the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. But what does that mean? One, what does it mean? If you do opt for that translation, and grammatically from the Greek, you could argue for this translation. It's not as though it doesn't have some merit. But the question is, what is he saying here? Is he talking about the righteousness of God and how you get it? The faith, while Jesus Christ was absolutely faithful to God at all points in his human existence, we know that. And that faithfulness extended right up through the bearing of sins. The point is, when he bore sins and he did all his things and he was faithful all through all this up to the death on the cross, is that when God bestowed righteousness? No. The faithfulness of Jesus Christ didn't cause the righteousness of God. I mean, in a sense, it's part of it, but that's not when the righteousness comes to people. It comes when they believe. So, again, the objective genitive, the common orthodox translation here is much to be preferred. But people, you know, there's no. If you're going to write a book and you want to be famous and you want to sell a lot of them, you got to come up with unique stuff. You got to come up with new ideas. And this is very nowhere else more true than in the religious world and interpretations. They'll try to find something new or unique, and rather than let the text force you to do it, for instance, that deal in the fig tree, when the text is like, Temple, fig tree. Temple, fig tree. Temple. You can't miss that. The text forces you to that. But here, there's no forcing away from an objective genitive here at all. This is just speculative, and it's designed to sell books, frankly. This is my opinion of it. That you got to say something new. Well, the arguments here, again, are not compelling to refute the orthodox interpretation. And also, I think it badly interrupts the flow of what Paul's getting at. He's talking about the righteousness and how people get it. Sure, Jesus Christ was faithful, and it's because of his faithfulness to God that we have a shot at this righteousness. But it didn't come to me through his faithfulness. I had to believe. The deal was faith. It was the faith that brings the righteousness of God. The work of Christ makes it possible, but it doesn't bring it to everybody. It's potential, but doesn't give it to them. So again, I don't see any reason here to change this at all. They've translated it very well here. It makes sense, and it follows the flow of Paul's argument. Righteousness comes from God through faith in Jesus Christ. That's it. 33, while the matter of righteousness from God is seen clearly in the work of Christ, the human aspect for attaining righteousness from God is appropriated only by means of faith in Jesus Christ. And 34, it is important to note that Paul is quite explicit that the object of faith is not God himself. See, how many people out there in the human race, unbelievers, millions of them, if you ask them, do you believe in God? Yeah. They'll do this every once in a while. They'll do these surveys and things, and then they'll give you, we found out now that 55% of Americans believe in God. Now it's down to 42. Now it's down to 8. Well, surely people don't believe in God as much, maybe, as they used to. But again, that's not even the issue. Faith in God won't save you. I believe in God, so does the devil. I don't think he's going to heaven. It will not save you. It will not get God to declare you not guilty. He's not doing this for the devil. So the object of faith must be Jesus Christ if one is ever going to receive the righteousness from God. James 2:19 kind of spells out explicitly here what we're talking about. And that is, now James is writing in a different context. And I also want to point this out. Paul's talking phase one salvation by faith. James is talking phase two justification by works. Completely different subject. Absolutely a different subject. Worlds apart, in fact. And so you have to, when you read these things, you have to know, okay, well, he's not discussing salvation phase one. Although, this verse here is still true. And that's the point. You believe that God is one. The demon, you do well. It's good to believe that, you know, there's one God. That was the Shema, which the Jews pronounced every day, twice a day. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God. The Lord our God is one God. And that was the orthodox view. That he's one God. He is one God. In his essence, he's one. Personalities, he's three. But he's still one in essence. Now, they don't accept the triune God. That's part of the problem with the Jews. But if they're unbelievers, why would they? I mean, this is a matter of faith and revelation in the Scriptures. You won't get this. And he said, you believe that God is one, you do well. The demons also believe and shudder. They think about God and they're scared. Why? What are they afraid of? They know what they're afraid of. They're afraid of the lake of fire and they know that's where they're going. They're on parole and they know it at best. They're out on appeal. And they've all got ankle monitors on. God knows where they are at all times. Using the modern, analogy. God knows right where they are at all times. And they believe in God. They know he exists and all that. And they're still going to go to the lake of fire. So believing in God won't get you saved. And the common person out there that thinks, oh, I believe in God, so he's going to honor that. No, he's not. That's the real message of the Scriptures that people have to understand. He's not. Well, 35, those that reject the orthodox interpretation often do so based on the phrase that follows. Now, the orthodox interpretation about the genitive back there, faith in Christ. The phrase that follows, for all who believe, claiming that it is redundant to speak of faith twice in so short a space. Well, this is his whole point. He's contrasting this whole idea of works. I think it makes perfect sense that he would emphasize faith. that he would reiterate it through here. This to me is not a good reason for their interpretation. And again, sometimes it's just a matter of being cute, I think. They want to have something unique. So 36, Schreiner indicates that such a view betrays a wooden nature of a view of language. And Dunn notes that repeating an idea in different words is designed to impress the concept more thoroughly on the readers. And so, you know, I'll say things twice and use different words to say the same thing. You say, well, surely he didn't mean to say that twice. Yeah, I did. And you may put it in different language in order to clarify. One, and of course, this is a matter of communicating with an audience, which Paul, when he's writing these letters, is doing from a distance, obviously. But when you're communicating with an audience, it's number one, if you're really trying to impress something on them, you are going to repeat yourself. There is going to be some redundancy built in to the comments. Well, 37, this makes very good sense in light of the fact that the human race is generally engaged in works-oriented religions. While the Jews were notoriously proponents of the works righteousness concept for salvation. In 38, therefore, Paul repeats this to emphasize the fundamental and essential nature of faith in Christ as the means, as the sole means, in fact, of obtaining salvation. That's the only way you're going to do it. So it comes through faith in Christ for all those who believe. And see, to me, that argues against this faithfulness of Christ. Because I think the fact is he's emphasizing faith in here as opposed to works. This is what he's fighting, is this works mentality. Okay, well, we're going to have to stop there today. It is our time. I thought I would get through this in two sessions, but I didn't. But it is time for us to observe the Lord's table as we do every quarter. So let's get all that in place.